KZMB All Zombie Radio.
Hi there, folks. This is Nick Salomon of the Bevis Rond, just having slurped down some cherry juice. How do they make that? Take out the pips, I suppose, and squash it. Anyhow, you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Acre, and legally we're clear. Hooray. Have fun.
Every Monday from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. you can listen to our Modulism radio show. Airing electro meet acoustic music, championing the use of analog instruments. The use of electricity to sustain a sound produced with a musical intent. Each program lasts 1 hour and is especially dedicated to one composer.
WGXC underwriting is provided in part by MPAC, presenting the Tope.
Well, 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 ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends, and enemies. Once again, you're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas, the name of the show. Good night, Norman. Unfortunately, I'm finishing a popsicle. I thought I would have finished a long time ago, but that's the way it is. Right here on WGXC. FM. Radio for open ears. I wonder how good of a sample that would be to hear me like sucking on the last bites of a popsicle. Okay. Okay, let's get the show on the road. It's the first day of September. That lovely month. The loveliest of them all. I mean, I won't go into why. Tonight, more fiction. We're going to start off here with the book Evil by Rennie Sparks. Back cover says 13 stories of misfortune and menace from Rennie Sparks, lyricist for the gothic country duo The Handsome Family. That's what the actual book jacket copy says. Then there's some blurbs from some anonymous writers for the Sunday Times and the Philadelphia City Paper that I'll spare you. Well, since it's autumn, I'm going to read the second story in the collection, Evil, Stories by Rennie Spark. It isn't actually autumn, is it? We're still 20 days away, actually. I have another show between now and the start of autumn. So really, I won't have an autumn show for another month. But anyways, I'm going to pretend it's autumn and read the story Springtime by Rennie Sparks. I used to love to sit in the park with the sun on my hands. staring up at the towering white oak trees and the teeny flowering buds on those high, quivering branches. I used to stare up at those buds and imagine a drop of sugar in each one. I used to sit in the park with the sun on my hands, watching the squirrels hopping about the garbage cans, nosing about through bits of stale hamburger buns, and the marching black ants lugging wads of pink bubblegum through the green grass. I used to sit there and feel like I was at an Easter parade, and all the creatures of the world were there prancing about in fluttering yellow bonnets. One day, I was sitting in the park watching the squirrels when I began to feel odd. I was imagining my fingers stroking the soft, ticklish fur that came curling out from the squirrels' jaunty little ears when suddenly I began to feel myself zooming in as if I had fallen off a high bridge or down a dark well. I felt like I was being pressed between specimen slides, and I could clearly see the horrible crawling fleas swarming the squirrels' gray matted fur and the screaming gnats circling the balls of dried feces that hung like apples from their tails. I watched the squirrels' black claws tear up tree trunks. And I saw that the trees themselves were glistening with the territorial urine spray of raccoons and were flecked with the jerking legs of blood-bloated mosquitoes, and above it all, the sun wailed and burned, a madman caged in the sky. I ran home and pulled down my shades. I defrosted a serving of Oriental beef by Swanson and tried to relax, but sitting there trying to keep calm, dividing my Oriental beef into perfect quarters, drawing smiley faces on my plate with a squeeze bottle of yellow mustard, still my eyes kept rolling inch by inch down the hallway toward my linen closet. I got up and put my ear to the linen closet door, and I could actually hear microscopic worms squirming their sluggish carcasses over my hand towels and spraying eggs in sticky, wet clusters along my white-fitted sheets. Quickly, I emptied the closet shelves and ran down to the laundry room to wash, dry, spray, starch, iron, fold, and stack by width and color every beach towel, mattress cover, tablecloth, and toaster oven cozy I owned. I rushed back upstairs, but when I opened my linen closet again, I saw that the shelves themselves were coated in a chalky white residue. I dropped the laundry, pried the shelves loose, and scrubbed them in ammonia and baking soda, but with scalding hot water until my fingers swelled up like sausage links, and I noticed a blinding ball of white light in the corner of my left eye. Finally, I climbed out on my fire escape and simply tossed the shelves out into the darkness. I went back into the kitchen. My Oriental beef was still sitting there, half-eaten, congealing like the rotten tentacles of some deep-sea monster, and I was so overcome with the sight of it that I began pulling all the food out of my refrigerator, filling three black garbage bags with bottles of cocktail sauce, boxes of frozen turkey legs, and jars of pickled okra. I dragged the bags downstairs and 11 blocks away to a dumpster behind a retirement village. There was an old man in a wheelchair out there, and he offered me a cigar if I would sit on his lap and sing Tom Dooley, but I turned and ran back to my apartment, where I proceeded to put all my dishes through the dishwasher 16 times, stacking and restacking every glass and plate I owned. My arms had long gone numb from loading and unloading the dishwasher, but it seemed wrong, terribly wrong, as if every juice glass lined up a centimeter off from the other juice glasses along my shelf of juice glasses was responsible for train wrecks and plane crashes and chipped teapots far into the next century. In a mad rush, I dragged all my dishes into the bathroom and piled them up in the tub. Next, as you can imagine, I filled the tub with a solution of 2 parts bleach, 10 parts sweet vermouth, a bottle of Windex, and 14 dozen roach motels. That's right, 14 dozen. I collapsed in bed, but my blankets felt grainy, swarming with dust mites. I could hear their crackling exoskeletons crawling on my rib cage, feasting on the tiny blonde hairs along the lumps of my spine. Mercifully, I was so exhausted I slept anyways. I woke up sometime after 3 a.m., and before I was even fully awake, I found myself pushing my set of 12 canvas director's chairs back and forth across the kitchen floor, back and forth, trying to align them into some invisible wavering grid that felt like a black and tangled fishing net thrown over everything. I emptied out my sock drawer, placing each sock in an individual sandwich bag, and then each sandwich bag inside a plastic margarine tub, and then stacking the margarine tubs inside a large Samsonite valise, which I dragged down the hallway and slid under my bed. But down on my knees on my bedroom floor, I saw how dull and dusty my bedroom carpet was. So I pushed all the furniture out of the room. Actually, I had to take a small axe to the legs of my cherrywood vanity and disassemble my canopy bed into 300 rods and screws to clear the door frame. But the room was finally cleared, and I began scrubbing the carpet with a bar of deodorant soap dipped in corn oil, after which I began laying down alternating strips of masking tape and tinfoil, 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 until I noticed that the sun was coming up, and out my window I could hear baby birds chirping, cackling really, and the skin on my hands had begun to peel off in long translucent strips, which I wrapped around paper towel tubes covered in cheesecloth and suspended from shoelaces out my bedroom window. Must have been afternoon when I opened my eyes again. I had fallen asleep with my left hand in the toilet bowl and my right in a box of Wheat Thins. I drained off my tub of soaking dishes, then grabbed a hammer and proceeded to smash every plate and saucer and spoon I owned. I scooped the shards into another bag, along with 10 years' worth of U.S. News and World Report, then immediately dragged the garbage bag downstairs and 11 blocks away to the dumpster behind the retirement village. The old man was still out there in his wheelchair, but he was asleep, snoring loudly, maybe choking, and his hair was matted with dead leaves and cigarette butts. I spent the rest of the day pulling the seams. Out of my clothes and examining them for insects. I dried all my potted plants in the microwave and ground them into a powder, which I poured into envelopes and mailed in random addresses from the phone book. I rifled through my medicine cabinet, swallowing, I don't know, some Dexitrims, 17 of them, a handful of Sinutab gel tabs, and a bottle of Jean Nate Afterbath Splash. I guess that's Jean Nate, sorry. I laid down on my living room floor and tried to relax, but the twisted antennae of fruit flies hung like cobwebs in the air, and I could smell gasoline from a service station 16 miles away. Then I spotted the ant, a black ant, trotting across my spotless wood floor. I leaned in closer and found myself reeling with nausea at the sight of the ant's bulbous alien body. The ant stopped only inches from my face, and for a brief second we were frozen together in this unexpected moment where everything suddenly felt ordered, like a cake cut into 8 perfect slices. And I remembered a morning from my childhood when my mother had slid a knife into a Boston cream pie at the exact moment I pulled the scab off my knee, and I had thought, oh, 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 life. Then the ant moved, and I came back to myself. I watched the ant turn, making a beeline toward my kitchen. I gave it a few seconds lead time, then leaped forward and flattened it under my shoe. The shoes had to be double-bagged and thrown out, and I was forced to pull up my living room floor and replace it with alternating squares of black and green tile, but I was able to sleep that night, and when I awoke the next morning, I grabbed my umbrella, my sunblock, and a long stick to fend off rabid dogs, then headed on out to the park. Rennie's Park. You are listening to your host, Norman Douglas. The name of the show, Good Night Norman. Presumably you have tuned in after turning on and will soon snooze out. I know that I will once I stop this broadcast. Actually, that's probably not true. Usually once I stop the broadcast, just like working late at the bar, for example, or anywhere working late or working not late, you just can't really hit the hay right away after a working day. You gotta kind of wind yourself down. I mean, that's my experience. I don't know about yours. So, yeah. I probably won't be, like, passing out right after this. All right, I'm going to try a different writer right now. Right here on WGXC.org. I'm going to try Ghost Roots Stories by Pemi Aguda. A beguiling collection of 12 imaginative stories set in Lagos, Nigeria. Aguda's book just came out, if I'm not mistaken. Or maybe it was a year ago. Let me see here. Copyright 2024 by the author. That means it probably just came out in 2025. I don't know. It's on Norton & Company in the United States and Norton & Company in London. Ghost Roots. What do I got here? It's touch and go. It's touch and go. Well, let's see what we can do. It's always like predicting whether or not I'm going to get to the end of the story, but probably if I didn't take so much time. I'm trying to decide whether I should read the story called Things Boys Do or Girly. I think I'm going to read Things Boys Do because That's what I'm going to read. Oops. All right, my apologies for the dead airspace there. But you can probably hear, like, weird noises in the background. Like, the train is going by right now. But you probably can't hear that. Things Boys Do by Pemi Aguda. Collection called Ghost Roots. The first man stands at the bedside of his sweating wife. He is watching their baby emerge from inside her. What he does not know is that he is watching their son destroy her insides, shredding, making sure there will be no others to follow. This man's wife is screaming and screaming, and the sound gives the man a headache, electric like lightning striking the middle of his forehead. He reaches out to hold her hand to remind her of his presence, but he is surprised by the power of her latch, this strength born of pain, the way she crushes the bones of his fingers. He has to bite down to prevent himself from crying out. And here is the baby, bloody and outside for the first time. The first man flinches at the sudden appearance of white eyeballs in the midst of the slimy red of birth. The doctor says, frowning, "You have a son?" The first man leans down to catch the mumbled words from his wife's mouth. "Yes, hon, he's alive," he reassures her. The whites of the baby's eyes are imprinted in his mind, behind the headache, like an image from the past, blurred and clouded by time. He looks up to the doctor, who is still holding onto the baby, brows furrowed. "He's alive, right, doctor? Is everything fine? Isn't he supposed to cry?" The doctor looks everywhere but at the first man. They fuss around, the doctor and the nurses, snipping, cleaning, moving. "Doctor," the man prompts, "Mr. Man, you have a son. Congratulations, a living, breathing boy." The second man huffs beneath the weight of his wife. The Ikeja General Hospital has sent them home, even though his wife is still bleeding from the birth. "Sorry, no space," the head nurse told him, her attention moving so easily to the next patient. "Take her home. Everybody bleeds." The second man's mother holds open the door to their apartment, cradling the baby like an expert. She trails them to the bedroom, where the man gently lowers his wife to the bed, still messy with signs of frantic packing for the hospital. Once his arms are free, the mother transfers the baby to him, as if she has been waiting to rid herself of the infant. "Mommy," he starts to say, but his mother leaves the room. The baby is sleeping and his eyeballs move around beneath his thin lids. The second man is repulsed by this unconscious shifting, like a buried thing digging its way up. The man is then discomfited by this reaction to his child. He deposits his new son in the cradle that smells like wood polish, then goes to find his mother in the kitchen. "Mommy, will you make black soup for her? Will that help?" The mother is staring out the kitchen window, her fingers steeping in a bowl of unclean tilapia. "That baby's not yours. I'm sure of it." "Mommy, please, don't start this rubbish again. That baby is not yours. I can swear on it. I know it. I feel it." Her hands move again, lifting a gill flap, gutting the fish with a soft snap. The third man walks into the dining room to find his wife dozing off while their baby quietly suckles at the feeding bottle's nib. The image he encounters in this, her neck tilted backward and to the side so that the muscles seem contorted unnaturally, the tendons and veins pushing against skin. For a moment, he is sure she is dead. She jerks awake when he tries to lift their son from her arms. Her hands instinctively tighten, then loosen. "Thanks," she whispers, her eyes drifting to close again. The man is impressed at how quickly she seems to have bonded with the baby they accepted from the arms of a teenage mother whose name they were not allowed to know only 3 weeks ago. The third man rocks the baby the way they were taught at adoption classes, softly, softly, back and forth. The baby's eyes flutter open, and the man smiles down at his son, his first child, his baby, Who's a good boy, he sings, hoping that a bond will grow between them two. Who? The baby does not smile, but do babies this young even smile? The third man now feels silly because of what seems like a stern look from the infant, as if the voice he has put on is simply ridiculous beneath him. How does one feel embarrassed in the sight of a three-week-old baby? He frowns at the child, noticing for the first time some flecks of gray in his irises. He blinks, startled, but the gray is gone. A wink, a flash, a warning. You're not a good boy, the man whispers, queasy, no longer singing, no longer rocking. Are you? There was another boy once, but that was so long ago. The first man is alone with his son again. His wife is in the hospital again. Since the birth 6 months ago, hospital visits and extended stays have become commonplace in their household. Money is running out. The first man worries about money. He worries about his job. All the time off he's been asking for, he worries about his wife. He worries about their baby. But that's not true. He doesn't worry about the baby. The baby is fed and cared for by his extended family network in Dabiokuta. His cousins and friends take turns helping out. What the first man is really worried about is himself. The first man worries for himself when he is alone with John. John is what his wife insisted on calling their son, short for Jonathan, that man in the Bible, only known for being a very good friend to David. This fear of his son for himself, it is a body thing, a visceral thing, a flinching, recoiling, chilling thing. What father is frightened of his own child, scared to hold him, scared to be looked at by him, to be really seen by him? The second man's wife is dead. Now he is alone with Johnny, their six-month-old son. The barrage of love and support that immediately followed his wife's demise has slowed to a trickle. The bowls of rice and soup have stopped coming. His brother has gone back to Abuja. His cousin no longer stops by on the way to drop her kids off at school. The second man is alone with Johnny. His mother showed up at the burial, but nose in the air. She did not make a scene. She did not hold Johnny, but she did not bring up more preposterous accusations about his wife's fidelity either, about the strange face of his son that she insists does not belong in her family lineage. Second man washes Johnny roll from his back to his stomach on the multicolored mat splattered with ABCs, then to his back, then to his stomach, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. The man backs away to the other end of the room, 1 foot behind the other. He sits in the armchair that still holds the cloying scent of his wife's shea butter. Back and forth his baby turns, fists flailing, chubby legs kicking. The second man closes his eyes against this familiar feeling. The sight of his pivoting son makes him dizzy, askew, off-center. The email was short. I can't do this anymore. Adopting this baby changed me. I need to find myself again. And if I do, I'm not sure I'll want to return. Be kind to J-Boy. Be kind to yourself. The third man reads the email every morning before getting out of bed. He reads it again this morning. Then he checks for new messages. Fuck, he whispers when he reads the newest text. The latest nanny has quit. I'm sorry, but have to go back to the village to care for my family. Bullshit. The man knows. It's all bullshit. The ninth nanny in the 3 months since his wife's been gone. The excuses are always unbelievable. Unimaginative. The third man leans over the cradle beside the bed. J-Boy is awake. Does the boy ever sleep? Why are you sending everyone away, J-Boy? Why? Because the common denominator is the boy, isn't it? The wife leaving, the nanny scurrying out the door, unable to attribute what they are balking at. Overcome, the third man slams his open palm against the side of the cradle. Why? 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 His hand is throbbing now with pain, with shame. But the baby does not react, does not flinch. He's just staring, still staring, as if he has expected this all along. This breakdown, this debacle, this undoing. Looking at his heaving father like, well, like, hello, like, I knew this, you would show up soon. That boy from so long ago, he was just another boy. The same way our three men once were just three boys. Just three boys doing things boys do. The first man can no longer sleep at night, not while it is just him and John alone at home. His wife is gone to live with a cousin in Seychelles. She needed bed rest and ocean breeze after the trauma of the birth. When he opened his mouth to protest what seemed to him like abandonment, she looked at him so sadly and disappointed, shutting him up. These days, he catches an hour or two of sleep when he can, convincing someone to come over, leaving his dwindling friends disgruntled because they thought they were coming to hang out with him, not feed his baby while he naps on the couch, drool glistening on his beard. "I'm not your fucking babysitter," his friend Joy said, plopping the baby on his chest, jolting him fully awake. The first man's nights are fraught with a fear of John that rises from the top of his stomach, acidic and pungent like the beginning of a burp. Tonight he moves slowly toward the cradle as if afraid of what he will find, but there John is awake, staring at the turning fan. The baby becomes aware of his presence as his eyes move in an arc from the ceiling fan to his father's face. His face reddens. His mouth trembles. He begins to wail. The first man's fatherly instincts kick in. He tamps down his fear. He picks up the baby, pats its back. The wailing stops, but only because the baby's mouth has now affixed to his exposed shoulder. There's a sharp sting that sends the man's eyes, even eyes backwards, upwards. How many teeth does this 8-month-old baby have? How can they be sharp enough to cause such precise, penetrating pain? He gets a finger between and pulls the child off with a smacking sound. He resists the urge to fling John back into the cradle. Jaws clenched, he lowers his still son. There's no more wailing. This is his life now, downgraded to managing social media for a small brand that pays peanuts but allows him to work remotely. This is his life, nappies that stink, formula that smells sickly sweet, and a baby that bites him too often. He distractedly rubs against an old bite mark adorning his wrist. Then he wipes saliva off his shoulder, wincing at the rawness. Sitting in front of his laptop, he clicks to the troubled Niger Fathers forum he's found recently. "I think my baby hates me," he types. The keyboard clacks echo around him. He has taken everything from me. I am so afraid of my baby. Is this normal? But before he submits the entry, he remembers to make himself anonymous. Then the first man leans back into the chair, glancing briefly at his now gurgling son. Is that a gurgle or a laugh? He turns back to the screen. The first man waits. The second man feels seen when he reads the post on the popular forum. Yes, he wants to scream at his phone. What he does instead is move to another room, one where Johnny isn't present. He hunches over the device, afraid that his son, not even a year old, will somehow prevent him from replying to this post. Me now, I am afraid to be alone with my own child. His very existence has undone me. Is this a medical problem? Something about a version of myself existing outside of me, disrupting my balance? Is there a solution? Do I need therapy? Sorry to ramble, but I feel so strongly. Help us. Then the second man hits send. He does not make himself anonymous. The third man, who has been eyeing the same post in the forum, clicks on the new and only comment. He recognizes the name of the commenter immediately. His fingers spring off the mouse and hover over it, as if electrocuted. There is no such thing as coincidence. No, 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 the third man thinks. He has not allowed himself to think about this person alone, what he represents, in so long. Yes, children can be cruel, evil even. So long ago, when three boys cornered their classmate, the new boy, the slight boy with asthma who wheezed at the back of biology, the boy who begged to be left alone. Please let me go, he cried. He promised his pocket money, chocolate bars, slide all his dinners to them, to iron their uniforms, and make their beds, do their chores, tend their portions of the school garden, fetch their water. Do all their assignments. He had promised everything. Just don't put me in there, he begged, please. That space is too tiny, he cried. Please. Please. But boys will be boys, right? The three best friends bundled him up and stuffed him in the locker at the back of the abandoned woodwork shop. He scraped at the wrist of their gray uniforms. His head wagged back and forth, left and right. He pleaded with his eyes, with the veins bulging in them, with his wails. He clawed at their faces. He bit at their shoulders. He thumped at their chests, scratched at their foreheads. But he was nothing but a whiff of a boy. They snapped the padlock abut, giggling, smacking each other on the back in mirth and solidarity. How easily attention shift. What should have been half a class period became one, two, three. How easily boys can be distracted by other social activities, other friends, other weak students to tease. How easy it is to forget. After they have confirmed what their bodies already know is true, through furtive private messages. Is that you? The same one from Hayden High School? The first man, second man, and third man wait till the dead of night. They wait till they think they cannot be seen. When John, Johnson, and J-Boy are asleep. And then, with trembling fingers, they search the event they are all thinking about. The event of their boyhoods. Over a decade later, the search results are not many, and he is faceless, but there it is. Adebayo Juan. Gone too soon. His three friends killed by an accident. Not looking at each other. They lied to teachers, to their parents, then themselves, revising. Each boy leaving the school one after the other to begin their forgetting of Adebayo John, who never did anything to them. Watch as these men, who were once boys, look to their sleeping sons, now alert to the possibilities. The terror latches on to wrists, yanks them in. They look to their sons, who have taken everything from them, who are still taking everything from them. The sons bound to them forever. And 2 weeks or 3 months or 4 years from now, when these men try to rid themselves of their sons, abandon them with relatives or on a park bench, wet from rain, they will never be able to walk away, because they can never to be sure where a haunting ends and a paranoia begins. But right now, watch them behold their sons, terrified by the possibilities, with hitched breaths, ticking pulses, raised hairs. And, do you know, terror can feel like being trapped in a dark, tiny place with no space to move, like a locker, a coffin. All right, that was from the collection Ghost Roots. It was a song called Things Boys, and a story called Things Boys Do. And it was written by one Pemi Aguda. Just came out last year. It looks to be all right, I'm going to drag out this last book and hope I make it to the end of this tale. This last book is by Molly Ogan. And the name of the book is The Sea Gives Up the Dead. Okay, this one is called My Husband and Me by Molly Ogin. Dear Abby, My Husband and Me, by Molly O'Gunn. I've been married to my husband for over 40 years, and we have always had a very good marriage. We met at a party in college. I was 20, and he was 21. And the hostess fumbled the fruitcake she planned on serving, and it fell on the floor. He and I were the only two people who were still willing to eat it. The rest of the party carried on in the living room, but he and I ate the sullied fruitcake standing up in the kitchen. I fell in love with him over the course of that conversation, and he fell in love with me right back. He was engaged to someone else at the time, but broke it off for this over the strength of that fruitcake, and we've been together ever since. I want you to know that this is what I mean when I tell you our marriage is good, and that he's very good to me. I have known from that moment that we would be together forever, from fruitcake to death. The trouble I'm writing in about stems from our disparate sex drives. My husband's always had a very strong libido, and he's always been crazy about me. When we were younger, we could spend whole days in bed together. I used to like it, although I never wanted it quite as much or as often as he did. But in the last few years, my appetite for physical pleasure has shrunk to the point of non-existence. I had a health scare a while back that resulted in a hysterectomy, and afterward I simply did not want to engage in that kind of activity anymore. My husband rejected this choice, of course. He would never pressure me or ask me to do something I did not want to do, but it's been difficult for him because his libido is as active as it ever was. We discussed potential solutions and compromises that could work for both of us. At first, he tried pornography, but he said the videos left him cold. It was too impersonal, too violent, not something he could become engaged in at all. I told him I could give my blessing to an affair if he promised to be discreet and come home to me, but he was offended at the idea. He told me he's too crazy about me to think of touching another woman. Bringing in a professional was dismissed for the same reason. For a while, he tried masturbation, that is, he would lie in bed next to me and pleasure himself, and sometimes he would hold my hand or touch my hair just to feel close to me while he did it, but that quickly fell apart. I didn't like hearing the noises, and I didn't like him touching me or even the way he kissed me when it was done. There was something sad about it, and the sadness began to make me feel sadness. Inadequate, like he was expecting more of me, even though he never asked for anything else. He told me it began to feel inadequate for him, too, because my discomfort made him feel uncomfortable. For a while, he went to the guest room to masturbate, but he complained later that it had made him feel lonely, almost ashamed. I want my husband to be happy. I want him to have what he wants. I asked him what he thought about when he took care of himself, and he told me he was just thinking about me, about things we did together when I still wanted to. You understand how badly I wanted to give him what he wanted and how impossible it was? I was the one who found the website after long hours of research that frankly made me ill. There's a site where one can purchase lifelike dolls designed to the exact specifications of the purchaser. These aren't cheap dolls. They cost thousands of dollars, and the money goes toward making them as realistic as possible. I showed the site to my husband, and at first he was reluctant. But the more details I showed him, the more interested he became. The site advertised that their skin felt warm and lifelike to the touch. Their hair was made from hand ventilated wigs. They blinked. They came equipped with little internal pumps that made them appear to breathe. They could be programmed with a series of realistic sights and sighs and moans or even short phrases. It seemed to fit all our requirements. It might make him feel less lonely. It wouldn't be at all adulterous. And he could be as gentle and specific in the doll's treatment as he wanted to be. I left him to discuss his plans with the designer and complete the order. Several months went by. Then the doll came in a big white boat. It looked like the kind of box expensive roses could be sent in, except, of course, it was much bigger. I helped my husband carry the box up to the guest bedroom, where we agreed he would keep the doll. Where we agreed he would keep the doll and conduct his activities, and from then on I expected to have nothing further to do with him. That was, after all, the point. Abby, I thought it was working. My husband seemed happier, livelier, more relaxed. I was happy to spend time with him without feeling like a disappointment. I was even proud of having finally found the solution. We went to our daughter's graduation together, and one of her friends asked me what the secret was, how two parents could still be so obviously in love and happy together even after 40 years. I laughed and told her the fruitcake story, but of course I was secretly thinking to myself, imagine if she knew the answer was a high-end sex doll. Abby, I thought it was working. Then it happened. I was cleaning in the guest room because our daughter was coming to visit in a few days before her graduate program began. I opened the wardrobe to get fresh linens, and there it was. I knew what my husband was doing, of course. I had a note written down to remind him to move the doll out of the room before our daughter arrived. But I had forgotten to expect the doll itself, hanging on a hook in the chest. Apparently, hanging is what the manufacturers recommend after cleaning the product to let it air out properly. The doll looked like a person. It looked like a girl was hanging up in the closet, drifting slightly on her hook. Her skin had a human flush to it, pink at her joints and the base of her neck, where my skin heats up when I get fluttered. Her hair formed loose brown waves, exactly like my hair used to before I hit menopause. She was very slim, a size 6. I knew she was a size 6. I haven't been that small since before my daughter was born. She had a familiar constellation of moles on her jaw, on her left thigh. She was me, Abby. She was me, exactly as I had been when I was 20 years old eating that fruitcake in the kitchen. I couldn't help myself. I reached out and touched her. There was a button at the nape of her neck. In a moment, her familiar chest started pushing with pre-programmed breath. Her skin grew warmer. My husband had dressed her in a nightgown, not one of mine, one he'd purchased in her smaller body. But it looked like something I would have worn 40 years ago. I pushed the nightgown off her shoulders and her breath quickened. Naked, she looked even more like me, like the girl I once was. Every detail, the exact shade of... the exact shade of her nipples, the softness of her belly, the little scar on her hip from an accident I had as a child was mine. I pressed my hand to her naked chest and she opened her eyes, my son, and moaned with my voice. I was crying by then. I pulled her down off the hook. Part of me wanted to tear the doll apart, take her out of the world where she belongs. But I couldn't bring myself to do it. She was warm in my arms. I put her back into the nightgown, and then I ran to my room and grabbed more clothing for her. A coat, a hat, underwear, socks. She was lighter than a real person would be, but still too heavy for me to lift. I dragged her out of the house and bundled her into my car. In the passenger seat, she looked like she was just curled up and asleep. She was 2 years younger than my daughter. She looked like a baby. I drove 2 hours to my brother's house. He helped me bring the doll inside, although I was sobbing too hard to answer his questions about her. When I turned my phone back on, there were dozens of missed calls from my husband, who, of course, was worried sick about me. That seemed like a good place to stop, since I'm not going to make it through that story. I'll start off with it next time, though. It's a good story. You've been listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas, right here on WGXC.org, Radio WGXC 90.7 on the FM dial in the beautiful Hudson Valley, with offices in downtown Catskill on Main Street, New York, and way out in the boondocks. I haven't figured out how to play music, so I'm just gonna sing. Bet you're going fishing all the time, baby, going fishing too. I bet your wife, your sweet wife, is gonna catch more fish than you. Just say anything by it, but you got bait. Here's a little tip that I would like to relate. Many fish bites if you got good bait. I'm going fishing. Mama going fishing. And my baby's going fishing too.